staggering account of the Sermon on the Mount, which I don't pretend to understand at all. It's coming from the silence on the dock of the bay, from the brave, the bold, the battered heart of Chevrolet. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining me now is Gar Alperovitz, who is an historian, political economist, activist, writer, and former government official. He is currently a professor of political economy at the University of Maryland and is a former fellow of King's College, Cambridge University, Harvard's Institute of Politics, and a guest scholar at the Brookings Institution. He also served as a legislative director in the United States House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate, and as a special assistant in the Department of State. He is the co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative at the University of Maryland and a member of the board of directors of the New Economics Institute. His most recent books include America Beyond Capitalism and Unjust Deserts, and he has an article at the Washington Spectator, Something is Happening, the New Economy Movement. And his latest book is What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gar Alperovitz.
Well, thanks for having me.
The title, What Then Must We Do? That rings a bell. Tell me, what did you borrow that from?
Well, it's taken actually from Tolstoy.
That's where it was, yeah.
And he got it actually from the biblical reference in Luke 3:10, which leads the argument in Luke is offers what then must we do, and it moves towards a vision of sharing amongst all peoples. So it's a very interesting title, both from Tolstoy and if you trace it back to Luke.
And in terms of your article, Something's Happening, the New Economy Movement, you know, the article makes the point, of course, that American wages for American workers have been stagnant for over three decades. And meanwhile, the richest 400 individuals own more wealth than the bottom 180 million Americans taken together. And incidentally, the Walton family, these are the heirs whose only contribution to humanity is that they were lucky enough to be born to Sam Walton. Their total wealth, the family, the heirs, their total wealth is the equivalent of the 30%, the bottom 30% of Americans. So we're aware of the growing disparity and the extent to which the country has become ruled by oligarchs in a kind of corporate plutonomy. But we're not aware of this emerging new economy that's bringing together organizations, projects, activists, theorists, and citizens committed to rebuilding the American political economic system from the ground up. So give us the good news, if you will, Gar.
Well, it's just beneath the surface of most media attention. And you know, the newspapers have lost so much both staff and money that they can't really cover what's going on the ground. And part one of the reasons to write this book was to report on things that people simply don't know about because the press doesn't cover. But just to give you some ideas of if any system is organized largely around who's got the money or above all who owns the wealth, the concentration you mentioned is almost medieval in the United States. Indeed, I once mentioned that in a lecture, and a medieval historian came up afterward and said, well, it was never that concentrated, even in medieval times. This is extreme. The contrary to that would be a democratic ownership of wealth or democratized ownership. So examples that abound in the United States most people don't know about. 130 million Americans today are members of one or another form of co-op. And there are agricultural co-ops. There are housing co-ops. There are credit unions are part of that. Many, many different forms, and a burgeoning number of new economy co-ops, younger people getting into building cooperative companies, worker companies, sharing companies of various kinds in the cooperative mode. And that's a different way of owning wealth and productive wealth in particular. Another example, again, that most people are not aware of, there are some 10 million Americans who are working in companies owned by the workers themselves. That's 3 million more than are members of unions in the private sector. There are 4,000 or 5,000 neighborhood-owned corporations, another several thousand land trusts, perhaps not quite that many at the last estimate. That's hard to pin down because they're not covered. A land trust is a neighborhood nonprofit ownership of land in a way to prevent gentrification. There are 2,000 city utilities, electric utilities, municipalized ownership, if you like. Socialism, quote, at the city level, city ownership of productive wealth, in this case, electric utilities. I could go on, but the point of all this is that there is an existing substructure of the economy that is already democratized. And more important, and this is really the point of the book and of What Then Must We Do, is that this is growing, and it's growing because the pain levels are growing, and people are being forced to innovate. But as they innovate, they're creating a whole series of what some the term now nowadays is new economy efforts, quote, around the new economy, all of which in one way or another are characterized by transforming ownership to decentralized ways, to decentralized democratic forms of one kind or another. And again, as I say, it's being driven, and I think is likely to continue to be driven by the growing pain levels in the economic system.
And Guy Rapovich, you're talking about evolution as well as revolution here. And is it possible? It seems to me that the main economy, the one run by the oligarchs, they're running it into the ground because they're all about extracting wealth, not creating wealth. I mean, is that how this is going to evolve? In other words, as the vulture capitalists and the Wall Street people who are driving the growing financialization of the economy and you know, the richest people out there are these hedge fund people who do nothing. They just speculate. To my mind, this is the big economy is on an unsustainable path. So is the new economy going to emerge, continue to emerge as one becomes more self-destructive, the other one will generate? Is that the vision of the future we're talking about?
Well, I think that's the general overview, but nothing, you know, I wear a hat as a historian as well as a political economist. Obviously, nothing is certain. But the tendency and the trend, and, you know, people are often very pessimistic because they look, and rightly so, because they look at the trends in growing poverty and growing ecological problems, climate problems, the concentration of political power. And if you look only at that, all you see is the destructive, negative trends of undermining democratic processes as well as poverty, ecological decay, etc. On the other hand, history often suggests that there's a reaction to those kind of trends. And I think we're beginning to see a reaction in all of these new institutions. And I do want to emphasize institutions because the reaction ultimately is both politics, that is movement building, elections, civil disobedience, a whole series of commonly understood things that happen in history that challenge at the level of politics. But even more important is simultaneously the buildup of new institutions that are, instead of trying to regulate the giant corporation, which turns out to be almost impossible to do now that the union movement is so weak, which was the basis of politics to regulate, instead of trying to regulate, the new economy vision is slowly to displace the larger economy with new forms. But they are institutions. So it's a double level. Politics on the one hand, supporting a new direction, but also simultaneously building up democratized ownership in different levels. We've been talking about neighborhoods and workplace and cities, and there are also state and national variants of this, which are also going on.
Well, one of the things I've been covering recently is the FCC, and I was talking to somebody that should have gotten the job as the new chairman of the FCC about how the old economy, the monopolies in the media, like Time Warner and Verizon that control the cable packages in the home, they're proactively going around the country getting these legislatures in states to preemptively pass laws that forbid local municipalities from providing utilities like broadband. And the contrast is extraordinary. You know, the city of Chattanooga, Tennessee, has the fastest broadband in the United States for nothing, for, you know, incredibly low rates, whereas Verizon and AT&T and Time Warner and Comcast are turning back the clock as monopolies, you know, gouging the consumer and giving them lousy service. So there you have the contrast. I mean, if you go the route that you're talking about, you get better service at incredibly cheaper rate. But if you're stuck in the plutonomy with these monopolies gouging us, you get screwed.
Yeah, I think that's right. There are several hundred existing, and there's an expanding cable system that are municipalized as well. And also several public utilities are doing the same. So there is an expanding trend in the positive. But part of the argument of what then must we do, in one chapter I take up what I call the checkerboard pattern. And it's an interesting way to think about just what we're talking about here. Because certainly there are many states and many cities that are going in a very negative direction, no doubt about that. And one has to face that, and probably the trend will be negative in those areas for a long time, that the power relationships are just out of whack and are going to go south rather than north. On the other hand, and this is the place, again, to keep your eye, people get caught in the negatives, there are many, many, many cities and states that are going in a different direction, Chattanooga being a good example. And there are developments in those cities and states that begin to suggest a much more positive outcome, and citizens experiencing a much more positive outcome, cheaper rates, better service, lower taxes. So the interesting thing to think about is this, and again, if you think about it as a historian rather than simply what's the snapshot that the television presents in the nightly news, as the pain levels increase in the one part of the checkerboard, and as conditions improve in another part of the checkerboard, we're going to have a very interesting dialogue between directions, the positive directions slowly building up and maybe even suggesting a different direction, even as people experience negative problems in the next neighborhood. And indeed, perhaps encircling some of the black spots on the checkerboard. So again, if you think about these over time, the situation looks much more interesting from a serious strategic point of view, particularly if we get to be self-conscious about it. Part of the argument of my book of what then must we do is to begin to understand things that are emerging that aren't reported on, like the things we're talking about, but also to begin to get strategic about it, to begin to understand that there is a possible strategy that, were we self-conscious, that is, progressives and activists who really are serious about this, we could begin to move, to the Chinese use a funny phrase, walk on two legs, build a new politics, build a new movement, but also simultaneously to build the institutional vision and on the ground that begins to point towards the new society or the next system.
And again, okay. I'm speaking with Gaur Alperovitz, a historian, political economist, activist, writer, and former government official. He's currently professor of political economy at the University of Maryland. His latest article at the Washington Spectator is Something is Happening, the New Economy Movement. And his latest book is What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution. And I was noticing that Noam Chomsky was giving you a plug here. I think it just happened yesterday or today. There's some important work being done by Gaur Alperovitz, who's involved in the enterprise systems around the Cleveland area, which are worker and community controlled. Tell us about that.
Well, let me tell you a bit about that Noam was talking about in Cleveland, and this will give you another example of what can be done any place. Cleveland, if you can do it in Cleveland, which is a devastated city, lost, you know, from 900,000 to less than 400,000 in the last 30 years, extreme poverty. It looks like a bombed out city in many parts. Looks like Detroit in many parts of the city. But if you can do it in Cleveland, the only thing stopping you in many other cities is that we haven't rolled up our sleeves and done it. And that's the point of this book, by the way, that there are things that can be done, like what I'm about to talk about. And what's stopping us is people don't realize that other people are doing it and you can do it as well. So in Cleveland, there is a complex of very sophisticated worker-owned companies built in part on the Mondragon model, which is the Basque complex of worker co-ops in the Basque country of Spain that many people know about. And they're large scale, and this is in a very poor neighborhood. Average family income is $18,000. It's mostly black. One of the co-ops, worker co-ops, is a large scale, industrial scale, hydroponic urban greenhouse. It's on 3.25 acres of land. Its output production, it is the largest one urban greenhouse in the United States. Its production is about 3 million heads of lettuce a year. Now, to think about that, I just learned that means planting every single day 26,000 lettuce seeds. So this is a scale of the operation, very industrial scale. So that's one of the co-ops. Another one is an industrial scale in laundry aimed at the hospitals and universities, and it's probably the greenest laundry in that part of the country, maybe in the entire Midwest. It uses about a third of the water and a third of the heat, and it's a large-scale worker-owned company. And a third one is a solar installation company online to put in about as much or maybe double the existing capacity in the state of Ohio. And these are linked together with a nonprofit corporation. So they're not just freestanding co-ops. The idea is to build a community, not just to, you know, make some workers well off. It is designed to make workers well off, but also to build the community. So part of the profits by design go back to the nonprofit to help the community, and part of the profits go into a revolving loan fund so you can set up a new, keep setting up new companies, build out this entire complex. It's a community building strategy with worker control and management and worker ownership as well. So that's going on in Cleveland, and many other cities, by the way, are modeling after Cleveland. And there's a further example, just to give you an idea of what can be done and is being done in many cities, and as I say, can be done any place. In the middle of this complex are giant, and this is true in many neighborhoods, giant hospitals and universities. Cleveland Clinic, one of the most famous world hospital medical centers in the world, is there. University hospitals, Case Western Reserve University. Those three alone, in this small neighborhood of about 40,000 people, spend about $3 million. I'm sorry, $3 billion with a B dollars a year in purchases. That's in addition, there are salaries, and quite apart from this, there are also construction, just what they buy. So the model here that gets even more interesting is to use some of that purchasing power to purchase from the worker co-ops in a way to rebuild this whole neighborhood. And, you know, remember, most of the money in these institutions, hospitals have a lot of taxpayer money, and so do universities in terms of there's Medicare and Medicaid on the one hand and education money coming from the state. So that money is being recycled and focused in ways that build up wealth not in the hands of the 400 at the top, but in the hands of the workers who own these companies and whose output is devoted to trying to rebuild the neighborhood. So it's a very interesting, somewhat complex set of worker co-ops, but built around a whole different vision of how to go forward. And many other cities, as I say, are in the process of kind of replicating something like the Cleveland, being called the Cleveland model. I was just in Atlanta a few weeks ago, and they're well along to something they're calling Lettuce Works, which at the starting point is another greenhouse. And many cities, as I say, in the country, I think 10 are actively involved, and maybe another 100 exploring doing just this. So this is just the point of this is that it's a more sophisticated example of what is happening, what can happen, and it's the kind of thing that the book, What Then Must We Do, kind of reports on, because the press isn't reporting on it, and suggests a strategy that walks on two legs, that builds up new institutions at every level, and if we have time, we can talk about the state and national, that democratize ownership and begin showing a different way than the dominant system. And this is only one example, but a very interesting one that Chomsky mentioned in that talk that you referenced.
Well, in terms of the dominant system, Gary Opovitz, the Koch brothers and Alec and these other groups have been very aggressive since 2010 when they changed the legislatures. The state of North Carolina is a petri dish for the most radical right-wing governance. They own all. They now control all three branches, and they are rapidly and aggressively going after the poor, the unemployed, the children, cutting education, voting rights. We were talking earlier in the program to a professor in Missouri and Kansas City. The same thing is happening there with Governor Brownback. It's basically destroying state government, destroying education. So it's actually a lot worse, I think, what's happening in this country. And that's what's so extraordinary about what you're talking about here and why it's so heartening to hear is that, you know, it's true the press aren't reporting on it, but thank God it's happening, that it's not all bad news.
There are lots, and as I say, a part of it is being driven by the bad news, that the pain levels are growing and people are saying, you know, enough is enough, we've got to do something different, and we can't just rely on the corporations. So if the name of the game is who owns all the wealth, and it's certainly the top 1%, or certainly the top 400 have more wealth than the bottom 180 million, I mean, extraordinary numbers. Someone pointed out recently you could put 400 people in a large airplane, and they own more wealth than 180 million Americans. Well, the counter to that is democratizing ownership in one form. And that used to mean, you know, kind of the state takes over, the Soviet Union or state socialism. Well, a different model that's very American is building from the bottom, and I think ultimately moving up the line in what's called, the Catholic Church calls it subsidiarity, only moving to the next level up if necessary. And many, we talk about some of the states being taken over, like North Carolina. Well, other states are moving in a different direction. North Dakota, has for 90 years had a state-owned socialist bank, and it's been operating there for 90 years successfully with the support of farmers, small businessmen, the activists, progressives. It's a very, very successful, making money for the state. Well, it's been rediscovered, and 20 states now are considering legislation, or over the last 4 years, 20 states have considered legislation, and some of them have gone further along than others, with a view to trying to replicate that. Certain cities are looking at city-owned banks. I was just talking to someone in San Francisco who thought they were going to move in that direction. So that there's a whole banking crisis that's beginning to generate new ideas at the state level.
Well, thank you for joining us today, Guy Rapovitz. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Nick Guarino. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.